Not Vader.
Bright Reel 4. This new appointment which you had, which I suppose today would be called technical adjutant, although it was called technical officer at the time, this obviously was a specialist appointment. How did it compare as regards your status and prospects within the Corps with that of a general regimental officer?
Oh, it wouldn't really affect it. It might do me a little good, as in fact being an adjutant of a battalion is always regarded to be a step in the right direction, and that it shows you were highly regarded by your commanding officer at the time. In those days, of course, I had a workshop in the battalion, and I had fitters and fitter staff sergeants and sergeants working in that workshop, which isn't the case now, because now all the kind of repairs we used to do in our own workshops in the battalion are now all done by REME. Mm. So it was a cross between being a modern technical adjutant and being a workshops officer. And as such, I found it extremely interesting. Mm.
I asked you that question because I believe there are sometimes dangers in specialising too early in one's career, in the sense that the more specialised you become, the more limited the ceiling of the specialisation is, and therefore you're likely, by the skills you're developing, not to be able to apply them at the higher command levels.
I don't think that matters within the regiment. That is to say, I don't think a technical adjutant is any more adversely affected than an ordinary adjutant would be. It is not regarded as specialising. However, later on, when I went to the advanced class at Woolwich, then of course that was definite specialisation, and thereafter my prospects in the Corps were very slim indeed, and my prospects lay, and all my chance of advancement really, on the technical staff outside.
Mm-hmm. I see. From your point of view in taking the technical establishment over, did you find things were satisfactory, well organised, good facilities?
Yes, within the shoestring limits of the army of those days, one would have liked much more and better equipment. But we were as well equipped as one could expect. And again, the standard of skill of the fitters and mechanist staff sergeants was very high indeed. They could probably do with their hands and with a file and a few elementary tools, what people today might expect fairly sophisticated equipment should do.
As the technical officer, which of the machines which the battalion was operating with at the time caused you personally the most headaches, and what kind of headaches were they?
Oh, the medium tanks, undoubtedly, because they required so much maintenance to keep them on the road. They used to wear out their steering clutches very, very quickly. And of course, when tanks were off the road, I would be put on the carpet by the CO, who used to not necessarily tell me off for it, but demand to know why so many tanks were off the road. And then I had to explain, perhaps, that the reason was that the standard of driving wasn't perhaps as high as the previous season, and therefore they wore out their steering clutches that much quicker, and of course we could only repair them in the same time, and therefore comparatively the tanks were longer off the road. Those were the sort of headaches that one had, and particularly with the medium tanks.
Can you give me any more examples in addition to the steering clutch, particular headaches you have?
Well, track mileage was limited. You had to make sure that the beginning of the training season as far as you could. You had sound tracks on your tanks, otherwise they were liable to either wear out and have to be replaced or break during the training season, which again would cause the vehicles to be off the road. You also had to try and work out that your tanks were overhauled in the right succession, so that you always had the maximum number of tanks with as much residual life as possible at the beginning of a training season, because the medium tank, to some extent, was rather like an aircraft in that it really only had a limited number of operational hours of its engines and tracks and so on, and you had to make sure that these were at their optimum condition at the beginning of the training season, because if you didn't, then the blame would be yours.
Now, obviously, if you were operating in your base workshops, task would be much easier to carry out. How did you acquire the necessary mobility in order to be able to go to those machines that conveniently couldn't come to you?
Well, of course, we had lorries, which were fairly well equipped with tools and things, and things like relining steering clutches we could do in the field. We could go out with the lorry with the necessary fitters, and we could do that on the spot where the tank was broken down. You could also fit new tracks and that sort of thing on the spot. In fact, apart from engine failures, most of the more minor mechanical failures you could repair on the spot, given a good team of fitters and mechanics, which we had.
Hmm. Were there ever any occasions where you got other section officers who come along and say, look, these mediums are rotten, what they really need is so-and-so, and you would try, within the technical resources at your disposal, to make modifications in situ?
To only a very limited extent, modifications on those kind of vehicles are usually difficult to carry out, and again, you've got to be careful you don't make the vehicle non-standard, because, for example, we were always having to change complete steering clutches, let alone the linings and so on. Well, now one steering clutch has therefore got to fit another tank, and if you start modifying and playing about with them, you'll find you have non-standard components, and then you're going to be in serious trouble. Mm.
I notice with RAF officers I've spoken to, connected with the technical side, connected with the flying side, if they felt some particular little modification would improve their aircraft, they would be completely cavalier in making that modification if they could.
Yes, well, I would say that tanks are rather more heavy engineering, perhaps, than aircraft, and therefore it isn't quite so easy to do. Mm. Mind you, things like intercommunication within the tanks, we used to fit voice tubes and things like that. Those sort of aids to training we could do, but when it came to actual modification of the heavy parts of the tank, it wasn't really practical. Mm.
These voice tubes were for internal communication, were they?
Yes, so that the commander could speak to the crew. Otherwise, you see, he had to tap them on the shoulder. And,
I thought things like laryngophones were in operation
they tried
by
them
this
all.
Time.
They tried them all, but on the whole, again, this was perhaps a matter of local preference. Mm. Yes, we tried laryngophones and all sorts of things. But I must say, I think in our battalion, the most satisfactory thing was a length of hose with a funnel on the end, which you shouted down.
Again, the analogy with the ship.
Yes.
Yes. Well, what about the inside of the machines, where you weren't likely to make them non-standard but could make modifications, perhaps based on people's physical size?
Did you could alter a seat or something like that. Yes, you could do that sort of thing. Things which didn't interfere with the interchangeability of components from one tank to another.
Can you give me any examples of the kinds of things at that level, then, that you did at the time?
I can't actually remember.
Okay, never mind.
Anything other than intercommunication equipment. Mm-hmm.
I would imagine that in this job as technical officer, you were in a fairly key role from the point of view of being at a central point from which you could collect information about, say, weaknesses of particular machines. I wondered whether, in fact, you did identify weaknesses in particular machines, and if you did, whether you were able to do anything about it.
Well, yes, we did, and we used to put in reports. You had to put in reports on mechanical failures and so on. We certainly did that. There's no question about that. But, of course, in times when money is short, it becomes disheartening, as you've already discovered, when you put in complaints and suggestions for very sensible modifications, and they never in fact come back, because having gone up the line and been coordinated with complaints from other battalions, they then find there isn't any money to carry out the required modification. And of course in peacetime, in the 30s, under the economic stringency that there then was, it was jolly difficult to get money spent on modifications. And although we used to report them, certainly regularly, it was seldom that we got the satisfaction of seeing the result come out the other end.
Did you feel that with a special responsibility for technical matters, you actually had an avenue of communication, if you needed it, to places like Woolwich, Vickers, the Inspector of Mechanisation, and so on?
A bit too far off, I would say. You could put in your reports, but they always seemed a bit too far off. This, I think, was one of the advantages that we got latterly by having a certain number of technically qualified officers later on, one or two who went through the advanced class like myself, and also after the war there was the long technical staff course at the Royal Military College of Science, which had then moved down to Shrivenham. And I think that undoubtedly that was a lack in those early days, that there was a lack of communication between the higher levels of design and production and the actual users. And a number of efforts were made to make that good, which we'll talk about later. For example, the section that I was with on 21 Army Group was specifically designed to try and meet that.
We'll not anticipate that. Yeah. I was reading the an account of the 1936 brigade exercises, at the end of which Hubbard is quoted as saying, "The tank brigade this year was worse equipped than it has ever been before."
That may indeed have been the year that we had two-wheel drive Guy trucks instead of Carden Lloyds. And that's to say that the Carden Lloyd, although it was not a tank and could never be thought of such, was a tracked vehicle, whereas I dare say that may have been the year that we had trucks in place of any tracked vehicle at all, simulating a light tank flying a flag. Mm. I don't remember that year, but it may well have been.
Does that quotation strike a chord in you from the relatively low level at which you were operating at the time?
Oh, yes. I think we realised that we were absolutely operating on a shoestring, and we thought that was inevitable. We didn't believe then that a war was coming very soon, although I think when we thought about it, we realised there would be a war eventually while we were serving. We didn't realise a war was coming all that soon. Mm. And you see, the infantry used to simulate machine guns with,
football rattles.
Yes, indeed they did, you see. Well, if the infantry were simulating machine guns with rattles, then we could hardly complain about simulating light tanks with trucks. Mm.
Now, during this period, you got involved in the mechanisation of the 9th Lancers. Can you tell me in a whole story what you can remember about that, which must have been a very interesting experience?
Well, my commanding officer at that time was Lieutenant Colonel Clifton, who had been a cavalryman and knew the 9th Lancers quite well. I can't remember which cavalry regiment he himself came from. And I would assume, I don't know, that the commanding officer of the 9th Lancers probably asked Colonel Clifton if he could help. And Colonel Clifton said, "Well, I will send my technical officer down to do what he can." So I used to go down to the 9th Lancers and assist them with advice on training their drivers, of their Carden Lloyds and how to maintain the Carden Lloyds.
What sort of situations did that get you into? Could you tell me a little more detail about it?
Well, I would say just as one might as an instructor come advisor. I became friendly with the officers in the regiment. I used to feed in their mess when I was down there helping them. They used to help me. I kept my horse in their stables for part of the time, and they used to help me with fodder and things like that. And because I was keen on horses, of course, this made it rather easier for me to deal with the cavalry regiment probably than it might have somebody else.
Yeah. You'd by this time had a lot of experience of training tank crews within the RTC itself. Was the training which you became involved in with the 9th Lancer identical to those experiences you'd had within the Corps, or was the fact that you were converting a cavalry corps creating different kinds of problems that you wouldn't experience within the RTC itself?
Well, I would say this, that of course the personnel that I was dealing with in the 9th Lancers hadn't got the mechanical know-how and the driving ability that the people in my own corps would have, in that it was not until a soldier had been in a tank battalion for several years and probably got at least one stripe that he became a first driver of a tank. Therefore, he was an experienced driver and also fairly experienced mechanically, whereas of course with the cavalry we were starting from scratch. They were intelligent and they were keen to learn and they were very easy to teach, but they did start from scratch, as opposed to our own people who were always at a certain stage of training whenever you might pick them up.
Can you give me any examples of specifically what kind of problems this created? Or perhaps problems is too strong a word, difficulties.
Well, I suppose they had to have more elementary form of driving instruction than would have been normal in our battalion, but I wouldn't say it made any difficulty. Driving a Cardenoid is a fairly easy exercise anyhow, and they were intelligent men. In general, I would say that the standard of NCO in the cavalry was better than the standard of the NCO in the Royal Tank Corps, because in the cavalry it was traditional that the officers left much more to the NCOs than we did in our corps. In our corps, the section officer did a lot of the supervisory work, which in the cavalry would be done by the section sergeant. So that in that way, they probably had more initiative than say our own NCOs might be expected to have, merely because our own NCOs had been much more supervised into the way we trained in our battalion than you would expect the ordinary cavalry NCO to be supervised.
Mm. The general impression that can be drawn from most of the publications dealing with this period and this subject, that is the conversion of the cavalry, give the impression that there was in fact great resistance in the cavalry to mechanization. Does that conclusion square with your actual experience working with the 9th Lancers?
I would say no. I would say this varied from regiment to regiment. I should think that the senior ranks in a regiment were probably very sad to see the horse go and so on, but I would say on the whole it was accepted, and certainly amongst the other ranks and the junior officers it was regarded as inevitable and accepted as such.
Well, what sort of general impressions did you get from the 9th?
Oh, they were keen to learn. If they were going to do it, they were going to do it as well as they could. Well, they weren't resentful at my level, and neither were they difficult to instruct. They were keen to learn. If they were going to be mechanized, they were going to do it well. But there may, higher up, beyond my ken, have been some resentment about being mechanized. Mm. But not in the lower levels. In the lower levels in general, they took to it well. If they had to do it, they were going to do it as well as they could.
You make it sound as if it was all very straightforward and went off without any problems. On the other hand, and again, as a layman, it strikes me as an enormous problem to convert a horsed cavalry regiment into an armoured unit, even if they are armoured cars as compared to tanks?
I think it wasn't as difficult as you might think. On the other hand, of course, at this length of time, one tends to remember an overall picture and not remember the individual difficulties and so on. When you look back, you tend to remember the good times and not the bad times. And I think if I did ever have any bother with them, I've forgotten it. I don't remember that I did, but I would be quite prepared to say that it may not be have been quite as easy as I now make it sound, but that's all I can remember.
This period you spent with the 9th Lancers, from it, did you get any impressions of the attitude of this particular cavalry regiment to the tank corps, officers in the tank corps like yourself? I mean, did they regard you as sort of rather dirty, greasy individuals?
No, I don't think they did. I think they regarded us as a bit different, but I don't think probably any more different than they would regard the infantry.
Tell me again that nice little story about the cavalry officer who asked your advice about the car he should purchase.
Well, this again was perhaps rather typical of the sort of relationship. I was having lunch in their mess one day, and the officer next door to me said, well, as I was one of these mechanical people, could I advise him what was the best motor car to buy? And I said, do you really mean the best motor car? And he said, yes, I do. So I said, well, if you really mean the best motor car, then you should buy a Rolls Royce. And he looked at me very seriously and said, do you really mean that? And I said, yes. So about 2 weeks later, I met him again, and he said, I took your advice, and I bought a Rolls Royce. And it was standing outside the mess with his family crest on the door, and he was very pleased with it.
That says a lot for the cavalry's grasp or attitude to mechanical things, and also the social class of the cavalry, doesn't it?
Yes, fine.
So in May 1937, you were posted to Egypt, the 6th Battalion RTC in Abbasia. What was Abbasia like when you first went there?
It was very pleasant. It was the kind of soldiering that you read about in books of the period, probably not all that different to soldiering going back as far as the turn of the century. When I arrived in Abbasia, the station in my baggage, I was met by two or three officers from the battalion who immediately took charge of all my luggage, escorted me to the mess and gave me a drink and made me thoroughly welcome and thoroughly at home, as this was to be my new home. I think perhaps it might be worthwhile just saying a word about trooping in those days on the way out too, because when you went abroad in those days, you went on a troop ship which was a converted cargo ship, which was very comfortable from the officer's point of view, and one had a very enjoyable time. The troops, on the other hand, of course, slung their hammocks in what had been the holds, and trooping before the war probably was not at all pleasant for the troops because it might be hot and stuffy, but for the officers, going out abroad on a trooper was rather like going on a cruise holiday. It was very, very pleasant indeed, and this was continued when one arrived at one's unit abroad, where people were eager to welcome you and made you thoroughly at home.
And Abbasia itself, what was the setup there?
We had the old Turkish barracks in Abbasia, which were quite good barracks, except, of course, they were very much bug-ridden from the troops' point of view, and they used to have to go over their beds, iron bedsteads, once a week with blow lamps and so on. On the other hand, where we lived, which were in large houses, almost a sort of colonial style house, if you like, we lived in a house called Hakim House, H-A-K-I-M House, in Abbasia, with large gardens. It had various fruit trees growing. There were all sorts of pleasant fruits growing in the garden. We had tennis courts. Very much a sort of country house life, if you like, probably living in a mess. I had friends, one in Signals, one the Sappers, with whom I'd been at the RMA Sandhurst, living up the road, and we used to dine with each other regularly once a week, and it was a very pleasant social life. Of course, when I arrived, it was the beginning of the hot season, and we used to work from 6 o'clock in the morning until lunchtime, and then most people went to sleep in the afternoon. You had finished work by then, and after tea you played tennis and sport and so on, and in the evenings you might go to the cinema, whatever activities there might be in Cairo, and then you probably went to bed about midnight or something of the sort, because having had a sleep in the afternoon you didn't require all that sleep at night.
You said with whom you'd been at RMA Sandhurst, but I assume you meant to say RMA Woolwich.
I'm sorry, yes, RMA Woolwich, I did, I'm sorry. Yeah.
How was the 6th Battalion served as regards tank, equipment, facilities, as compared with, say, the 5th Battalion at Perham Down?
Oh, very similar. We were differently organised in that our companies were not organised the same way. I think we had medium companies as opposed to mixed companies. And it was an establishment which was really geared to what we imagined at that time desert warfare was likely to be. I don't think it was probably proved quite right when the time came, but in general the equipment was the same as we had in England, but it was organised within the battalion in the way that was then thought was the best way to undertake desert warfare.
What was then thought as the best way to undertake desert warfare?
I think a mobile concept, but I think also tank v tank battles much more than attacking soft targets, and this is probably why there was more emphasis there on the medium tank than on the light tank, because it was considered that warfare in the desert might very well be rather like naval battles, in that the desert was not unlike the sea. There were no big obstacles in the way. Visibility was very good. You could see a very long way. You could engage the enemy at far longer distances than you ever could in the close country, either anywhere in Europe.
Did the sort of training exercises you had reflect this kind of view of desert warfare?
Yes, I think they did, although I can't really say a lot about it because I was only there through the summer of 1937 and therefore I didn't actually take part in any big training exercises. The training season, somewhat naturally, was in the winter because it was cool. In the summer we did our gunnery and firing training and our individual training, but we didn't go out during the summer to do exercises as even a company, let alone a battalion.
You had by this stage reverted from being a technical officer back to acting as a section officer.
Yes, certainly I had. But of course, again, when you're not doing very much field training, but things like firing on the ranges, it doesn't make a lot of difference what your actual appointment within the battalion is, because you took your turn at running the ranges and doing the various training exercises that go on in the summer, and you really didn't have very much to do with running your own section other than the man management side and looking after your soldiers. But as regards operational training, there was little from your own command point of view.
Did you find that the Vickers mediums you were operating with had any problems that were peculiar to the conditions that you were operating in Egypt?
I think in general the problem of all vehicles in Egypt at that time was cooling. The thing was, you had to think up ways of having to almost all vehicles condensers of some form fitted, so that when your cooling system boiled, you condensed the steam that came out, and so you didn't use an undue amount of water, which of course in the desert is important not to do.
Did you have to fit these condensers yourself on the spot?
We did to all our wheeled vehicles. I can't honestly remember about what modifications had been made to the tracked vehicles, but they would have been done in workshops anyhow and would have been rather more sort of major modifications. But the standard thing for all staff cars, lorries and so on, was to put a petrol can on the front and with some water in the bottom, and to have a tube from your overflow from the radiator, so that when your radiator boiled, the steam went down into the water at the bottom of this can and condensed and gradually filled up the can, and then you could top up your radiator again. It was a very simple system. This was used not only on service vehicles, but most people who had private cars and liked to go out on the desert at weekends. Going out into the desert on trips in the weekend was a very popular form of recreation, and we used to go down to the Red Sea and